This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. So it's finally happening. The Middle East Peace Conference has opened in Madrid, and we're wondering what the outcome will be. Roger Fisher is one of the world's experts on negotiation. He's been thinking about the best process for reaching a peace agreement. Fisher is the director of the Harvard Negotiation Project and co-author of Getting to Yes, Negotiating an Agreement Without Giving In. Fisher says it's unlikely that a workable peace proposal will come from one of the involved parties. What they need is an outside mediator to draft proposals, and here's why.
Because the parties to the conflict themselves are under enormous pressure not to do that. They will be criticized, they'll lose constituents at home, and the other side will treat it as an opening bargaining position. So any compromise they propose is likely to prejudice them. The only reason to do it is to be able to blame the other side in public opinion. They see we were reasonable, blame the other side. And they're looking for the press and the support, not looking for what in fact would be an appropriate resolution to these difficult questions.
What is the United States' role in making proposals for an agreement?
The United States can make proposals. Obviously, they did that last eight trips to get this meeting started, to get the process started. The danger of making substantive proposals is the United States is not simply brainstorming some creative ideas. It begins to be a position of the United States.
You mean the United States would have its own agenda?
The United States has its own agenda, has its own constituents, they have their own congressmen, senators, Jewish organizations, Third World, everybody else listening to them, and they too are worried, looking over their shoulder, those questions. Also, they're likely to be leaping too quickly on a compromise and not saying, let's look behind their side's positions for their underlying interests. The Israelis say they won't give up the Golan, but what they really care about is security. We can handle security the way we did it in the Sinai. What the Palestinians say is they want a state. What they really want is acceptance, belonging, a place they can call their own, being treated as equals. What can we do about that? So A facilitator, a mediator, is not someone who simply splits the difference between stated positions, but looks beneath those positions for underlying interests, the underlying concerns.
If the United States doesn't seem like the right party to make a proposal, who would you see as a more neutral party to serve that purpose?
I think that obviously any other government willing to do it, whether I say the Netherlands, Denmark, Norway, France might do it, a non-governmental organization like Carter Center, Georgia, you might get one of the foundations to say we're going to produce three discussion drafts. After all, there are three solutions: the Jordanian Federation, independent Palestine, and a no-state, Israel territory. Let's look at what those might look like in practical terms. Let's ask some professionals to produce three good drafts for discussion.
Now, why would you have those three drafts for those three different alternatives, separate drafts?
So they look what they're really like. If you accept the premise that their Palestinians need a state, that Palestine should be a separate member of the UN, if you take that premise, what is the best way to meet Israel's legitimate security interest? To make sure it's unarmed, to make sure it has open borders, to make sure verification takes place and Israelis meet their concerns in security. You can do all that without offending Palestinian sense of belonging and sense of being accepted. If you say there's not going to be a state, then you say, well, what do we do about 1.7 million Arabs in territory that's now controlled by Israel? Simply, do you make them Israeli citizens? Do you give them the vote? What do you do? What are the demographics of what's going to be expectations? If you don't want to have a separate state, you want to belong to Jordan, be a federation with Jordan, how would that work out? What would the Palestinian leadership have to do to accept that? Those are three plans. I think they're about the only ones that are seriously being considered as an ultimate solution. And I think it would be helpful if instead of talking about all the terrible things that could happen, if there were a state, it might be a terrorist state with military weapons and so forth, say no. Suppose the deal was, et cetera, A, B, C, D. Let's look at that.
So this way you see all the options and all the consequences and benefits of each option.
You try to look at the three major options, try to work operational language as to what that might look like in practice. What would be a good answer to water, electricity, traffic, immigration, a settlement. Palestinians want to live in Israel. More Israelis want to move into the new state, new Palestine. What are some practical ways of dealing with that? And you try and block out the answers and block out procedures for dealing with the answers you haven't solved.
And what kinds of negotiations is this strategy typically used?
Well, the Camp David is the most process where for 13 days with everybody together, the United States went around and around among the parties, back and forth, working with the staffs of the Israeli delegation and the Egyptian delegation. The United States said, we're not yet sure whether we're going to make a proposal, but we are trying to see if we can invent a proposal that we will make. And after 13 days, the United States finished the draft, printed it up finally, and said, okay, this is the best we can do. Here it is. This is going to be more complicated than that interim arrangement, but I would think that approach of having a active facilitator trying to create, separate the inventing from the committing, have somebody really invent a good answer about which people can talk. It's very hard to invent an answer step by step where each word you say looks like a commitment and it may prejudice the final package.
It's possible that these talks in Madrid will actually result in an interim agreement providing Palestinians with self-rule in the occupied territories. Would you see an interim agreement as being a step toward a long-term resolution?
Oh, yes, it would be. But I would have people working concurrently on the long-term solution. It may be easier to reach the long-term than an interim agreement.
Why do you think reaching a long-term agreement might be easier than an interim agreement?
Because each phrase in an interim agreement, each side has to look and say, what's the worst consequence of agreeing to this? How might, this is a slippery slope. Suppose nothing else is reached, then what happens? And they're all worried about the future. You come in and say, here's the packet, here's the deal. It's not so bad. And you don't have to worry about all the consequences, because here it is.
Are you impressed with James Baker's negotiating skills, since he actually succeeded in getting the Arabs and Israelis to come to this conference?
Well, he has the admirable quality of persistence and ingenuity. I think, as many business people of Texas and elsewhere, when you basically think you're going to make a deal, I mean, use the example of, well, let's form a joint venture. Now, two business people will say, let's agree, shake hands on a joint venture. We'll work out the details later. I'll say, let's get married. We'll decide later where to live and when to have kids. But that's because somebody whom I have great confidence. When you're dealing with adversaries, most people want to know just what they're getting into before they take that step. And this rather elaborate package of letters of assurance, letters of what is committed to and what is not and what they're committed to, it tends to narrow the playing field by getting a lot of decisions up early. And it's there's not much room for freewheeling brainstorming and considering different ways of doing this. So I think he's a skilled negotiator. He obviously is a skilled negotiator. There's a lot of admirable qualities of ingenuity and persistence. He's prepared to use the leverage, some of the leverage the United States has. But I would, where you're dealing with this kind of adversary, I think a different style of negotiation rather than the big decision and fill in details later. I think the process is to let's look at all the details and see what that would look like in practice before anybody's committed to it.
You're a little critical of the means that James Baker used to bring the countries to the peace talks, but do you think he could have gotten it done any other way?
I'm not so critical of pressure on the parties to get there. I'm critical. I think he could have said, we're going to have a meeting. Everything's on the agenda. We're going to brainstorm it like this. We'll have some people there facilitating the talks. No one will be committed until some options are produced. And we're going to produce the options whether you show up or not. We're going to have those people who show up will help us brainstorm and think of some good ideas. We urge you to come. I think that rather than having to commit himself and commit everybody to particular things like a one-year period in which they'll try to reach interim agreement, which will then have 5 years, and they'll do it, they were locking in substantive points which perhaps need not have been locked in. I'm happy to take the initiative. I'm happy to the drive and the energy. I'm happy to have them pressure people to show up. But I would not, I think from little I know about it, that I would prefer to have the process more open and not have locked in the substantive outcome of this meeting.
My guest is Roger Fisher, director of the Harvard Negotiation Project. More after this short break. This is Fresh Air. We're talking about the Middle East peace process with Roger Fisher, director of the Harvard Negotiation Project. Do you think that most of the parties represented at the peace talks are there because they have to be, you know, because James Baker made them an offer they couldn't refuse, basically? And if so, how does that affect the way the talks proceed?
Well, he is counting on the chemistry of having people sit down and take on a task and carrying it forward. I mean, Jordan comes because they can't afford to stay away. They need to get the good graces of the United States and other Arab states. Don't want to disrupt Secretary Baker. Syria comes with its demands. They want the United States as an ally or friend in the recent Iraq thing. They want to show them the right side. They want to come along with that. The Palestinians are in a jam. They come because they think anything's better than the continual changing of the facts against them. And the Israelis are coming because they have to, because the United States has said, look, we want it. But I think Shamir will avoid blame by saying, I'm open to discussing anything. I'm always here, but I don't think he's going to agree to much. I mean, he states categorically he's not going to agree to give territory for peace. But of course he'll listen to it. Of course he'll listen. He wants to have enough flexibility. No, it's not very, it's not auspicious, although it's, I say, it may be essential. It gets committed. It starts the thing going. But I would want people in the corridors, outside the meeting halls and elsewhere, really looking at what might some, not just the interim arrangement that Secretary Baker's undoubtedly drafted his own satisfaction, but how might the more comprehensive settlements look?
The table at the peace talks is arranged in the shape of a T, with the Soviets and the United States sitting at the top of the T, and the others along each side. On one side, we've got the European community, the joint Palestinian-Jordanian delegation, and the Syrians, and they'll be facing the Egyptians, the Israelis, and the Lebanese. Is the shape of the table important?
Well, when you have this many parties, it may not be. If you have simply Palestinians facing Israelis, it tends to reinforce the adversarial nature. The other side of the table is the enemy, the problem, rather than sitting side by side looking at a map on which there's the problem. Rather than sitting side by side, we have to attack the problem, not each other. And the physical position in which people sit not only affects their status, but it tends to affect your thinking as to whether we're in this together, trying to deal with these complicated clauses and issues maps and issues we have here. You can put the words on the wall: water, electricity, boundaries, police, security, courts. But when you have the other side across the table, you tend to simplify and say, well, they are wrong. And you confuse the parties with the interests which they're entitled to have met.
The eyes of the world are on Madrid now, and the press of the world is in Madrid now. Does the kind of spectacle that surrounds the peace talks now, does that make for good negotiations?
No, the media tends to hinder constructive problem solving. It tends to cause the parties to talk to the press, not to each other. It tends to have them consider the problem of their image and not the substance of how we get to a good solution. It tends to augment the pressure saying, blame the other side. They're the ones at fault. It tends to put it a battle for will. And also the media, I must say, looking at Dan Rather and others, the questions he was asking Shamir last night. You know, I've got a little article I wrote once on how any good journalist can turn a conflict into a major war, which basically ask questions which lock the people even more publicly in a position. Will you never back down? Are you prepared to give up your homeland? Are you prepared to violate what you've told your constituents? And you tend to lock the parties ever more tightly into prior statements they've made. So the hardline news, wanting to get a headline saying Shamir says no land for peace, causes journalists, when they get a chance, to paint the people into a corner. So that the media is, it's nice to have the world paying attention to the problem, but the media's role is not always constructive.
So what do you think is going to be the outcome of these talks?
My job is not to predict. My job is to give advice and help people understand that each party today is reasonably saying no to what the others demanded. The Palestinians are reasonable in insisting on a state. If they give it up, they get nothing. Just by giving it up, they get nothing. The Israelis are reasonable not agreeing to a state today. If they agree to a state, they don't know what it means. So that both sides are reasonable in saying no to what the other is asking them to do. And we need to put some better questions on the table, some better choices. The parties will invent some of these. I think they're going to need help in inventing more. And I would like to encourage those who want peace in the Middle East to try their hand at drafting some illustrative drafts of what a non-state solution would look like that would be fair to the Palestinians and democratic for the people who were there. What would a state solution look like that would be fair to the Israelis and meet their serious and even more seriously perceived concerns with security? What are some possible answers? Instead of focusing on a spectator sport of guessing what the outcome will be, I think the odds are 42% that they'll do this or 60% they'll do that. Get on with making them better, improving the odds. I think there's likely to be some kind of interim agreement because George Bush wants something reached before next November. He wants to have a success of some kind. So I think that there'll probably be an interim agreement, but I don't think that's the question. The question is, how do we improve the odds of achieving an interim agreement or a final agreement?
Roger Fisher is the director of the Harvard Negotiation Project.